John chapter 2, we'll begin reading with verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. As far as the reading of God's word, you may be seated. If you're reading John's gospel and you come to the end, you'll find there in those closing chapters that on more than one occasion, John speaks of many other signs that Jesus did. He did these in the presence of his disciples, and the ones that are recorded for us were written so that we would believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing we would have life in his name. That's John 20, verse 31. It's what he uses, John says, really is a purpose statement for his gospel. So there are signs that Jesus did that he did in the presence of his disciples that John did not record for us. And there are signs that Jesus did that he did record for us. And those signs, we're beginning to see them this morning. There are, in John's gospel, traditionally it's understood that there are 7 of them. The first half of the book records these signs, chapters 1 through 12. It's even referred to at times as the book of signs. Chapters 13 and following begin to focus on those events leading up to and his passion, his death, and then, of course, his resurrection. But in these first 12 chapters, these 7 signs that John gives us, he heals the official's son. He heals the invalid man. He feeds the multitude, remember, with the bread and the fish. He walks on water. He heals the man born blind. He raises Lazarus from the dead. And here in John chapter 2, John records the first of those signs, the first miracle that Jesus did. The miracle that he did at this wedding banquet in Cana of Galilee when he turned water into wine. Signs. That's John's choice term for in Jesus' ministry, these works that he did. And he uses the term signs as opposed to what the other evangelists, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, use. Words like miracle, or words that describe his mighty works, his powerful works. But John uses the term sign to highlight these events in Jesus' ministry. And what is a sign? I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but we can think of signs on the road, which are very familiar to us. You're on the highway home and you see the sign that says Jacksonville, you know that sign is not it, but that sign is getting you there. Right? It's pointing beyond itself. It's telling you where to go. So signs aren't for the sake of themselves. They point to something else. Don Carson said that these signs in John's gospel, they're not naked displays of power. They're not conjuring tricks, but they're significant displays. You hear the term sign in the word significant, right? Significant displays of power that point beyond themselves to deeper realities. And that's what this first sign does. It's what John gives us. He provides this bit of commentary in verse 11 that speaks of this sign Jesus did and what it was about and what it did. It wasn't just about itself, but it was the manifestation of His glory, of Christ's glory for the belief of the disciples on Him. Now, this sign took place at the end of this week in the life of Jesus' ministry. Maybe we might say it's the first week in the life of His ministry. And interestingly enough, as we've been pointing this out over the last few weeks, right? In verse 29, the next day, in verse 35, the next day, in verse 43, the next day, and now in chapter 2, verse 1, 3 days after that, giving us a total of 6 or 7 days here. It's interesting, though, that John is nowhere else concerned with time like he is here. And we don't really know why. But could it be, perhaps, that his intention is to demonstrate to us how the one who authored creation, right, in the first week of history, the one that he spoke of in chapter 1 as who made all things, and without him was not anything made that was made, the one who was now become flesh to dwell among his people, could it be that he's wanting to show us with these time indicators how the one who authored creation in that original week is now inaugurating a new creation in this first week of his ministry life? There is a theme of newness that we find here in this text, and that we'll find in the next several chapters that we encounter. Here, John tells us that Jesus gives new wine in old stone jars. Next week, Lord willing, we'll see a new temple that Jesus speaks of, the temple of his own body as opposed to the old temple in Jerusalem. In chapter 3, he tells Nicodemus about the new birth. In chapter 4, he talks to the woman, the Samaritan woman at the well, and tells her of this new living water as opposed to the old water from Jacob's old well. And he tells her of a new way of worshiping in spirit and in truth as opposed to those old ways at Jerusalem or in the mountains of Samaria. Jesus came, as he would go on to say, to make all things new. And we see the beginning of this newness in this sign this morning, in the miracle of the water that was made wine. His disciples, they saw it, they believed. And this is the purpose, the same purpose for them is why John records it for us. He recorded Jesus' first sign that we may behold his glory and believe in him. We could say this about all the signs, I guess. But he recorded this sign that we may behold his glory and believe in him. I want you to see three things concerning the sign this morning. We'll see, first of all, the moment of Jesus' first sign. That is to say, the occasion and all that was going on for this miracle where it took place. We'll see the miracle of the sign, the actual thing he did in turning the water into wine. And then we'll see it'll be in verses 6 to 10. And then in verse 11, we'll see, as John provides this bit of commentary, the meaning of Jesus' first sign. So the moment, the miracle, and the meaning of Jesus' first sign. Let's look at the moment then, back to verses 1 through 5, as we'll consider all that was involved in and all that led up to this sign. First, verse 1 tells us about the occasion for the sign. It was a wedding. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. The third day, as I made reference to that a moment ago, it's likely the third day after just the preceding context there. If you remember from last week, Jesus met Nathanael, told him about him seeing heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Nathanael believed on Jesus just because Jesus knew whatever was going on under that fig tree. And so here we are, perhaps 3 days later, at a wedding. And the custom of such weddings in this day, that day, were a bit different than our own. You know, we get the invitation in the mail. We put the nice, happy couple up on the fridge. And we mark the date on our calendar for some Saturday afternoon later on. And when the day comes, we go, the wedding, the reception, we're done with it. Get a gift, and so on. But in this culture, a wedding was more than a ceremony. The word for wedding here encompasses the whole idea. But it was a true banquet and could last really as long as a week. And so it was a big deal, a lengthy, drawn-out event full of festivities. And so this was the occasion. John also tells us the location. At Cana in Galilee. That is to say, it's as opposed to any other Cana. There was at least one other Cana, but this one was in that region to the north of Jerusalem, that region in northern Israel, known as Galilee. And it was known as Galilee because of the Sea of Galilee. Cana, however, was not situated on the sea. It was a little further to the west. And just about 8 miles or so north, at least if the location is where we think it was, from excavations and artifacts that have been found that would sound a lot like what we find here in this text, about 8 miles north of Nazareth, where Jesus was from, is also the town, the city of Nathanael that we met last week. So the occasion, a wedding, the location, Cana of Galilee. There's also here in these verses an invitation. We see in verse 1 that the mother of Jesus was there, Mary, but also in verse 2 that Jesus was invited to the wedding along with his disciples. Now, usually the focus of the wedding is who? It's the couple, right? The bride and the groom. But we don't know who is getting married here. We're not told. We're told more about the guests than about the couple. And so Jesus and his disciples attended this wedding. They were invited there. We can only surmise that they were Jesus and his mother were close to the family. Perhaps they were themselves family or close friends. And we can gather this, that the disciples that were with Jesus, the only thing we can gather is that they were the disciples that we saw last week. Those five. Nathanael, Philip, Peter, Andrew, and then an unnamed disciples. Maybe John himself, as he gives us maybe what is a firsthand account. So the occasion, the location, the invitation. But then there was a complication. Verse 3. When the wine ran out, or literally, when the wine failed. No doubt most of you have attended many weddings. Some of you have been a part of many weddings. And some of them leave more of an impression on your memory than others, right? Just as I mentioned, weddings that you've been to. No doubt you thought of some, but not all, that you had been to. Whether it's the food or the setting, right? The location. The crazy uncle, the antics of the children. I remember seeing a child come down the center aisle with his arms raised in the air and he's growling on both sides at the guests as he makes his way down to the front. And he did so because they told him his job at the wedding was to be, as he understood it, the ring bearer. And so he's doing what a bear would do. And so there are things, right, that leave great impressions in our minds. Maybe the memorable way the bridal party entered the ceremony or a surprise rehearsed dance from the bride and groom at the reception. Sometimes we remember weddings and they make impressions on us because of the problems there. An outside wedding where it begins to rain on the guests or hail. An inside wedding where the air condition is broken in the middle of the summer in Florida. You want people to remember your wedding, but you don't want people to remember your wedding for those reasons, right? Well, this was the sort of thing that you didn't want people to remember your wedding for. that you were the couple who ran out of refreshments, that you were the ones who ran out of wine. It was to start your marriage off with a blemish, to be known for not having enough foresight or provision for your guests. And in this, it's hard for us sometimes to get our minds around the culture of the Near East and the Middle East, but in a culture of honor and shame, this embarrassment would have brought great shame upon the bridegroom who was responsible. But there's even evidence to suggest that there could have been a lawsuit. He would have been liable here if he failed to provide, hosted this feast, advertised it, and failed to provide for his guests. We don't know why the wine ran out. Maybe it was a lack of foresight. Maybe it was due to an unexpected influx of guests. John simply tells us that the wine failed. And that brought about a conversation. So we've seen the occasion, the location, the invitation, the complication. That brings us to the conversation. As Mary, Jesus' mother, comes to him, and she says to him, quite simply, they have no wine at the end of verse 3. Now, why did she know so much? Why did she care so much about the wine here? It may have been in the way she approaches Jesus to tell him this, and then afterwards, after the conversation, she goes to the servants and says, hey, you just do whatever he tells you. It may have very well been that Mary, I mean, it shows us they were perhaps close to the family. Perhaps Mary even had something to do with the catering here, partly responsible for it. But why would she come to Jesus in this way? I mean, we might think that, as most people think, that by now Joseph is dead. He's not mentioned any further past Luke. Remember when Luke tells the story of Jesus when he's 12 and they realize they don't have him, and they go back to Jerusalem. He's there in the temple. And it was likely that Mary was a widow at this point, that Jesus, who was not only known as the carpenter's son, but I think in Mark's gospel referred to as the carpenter, that it was his responsibility now to provide for his mother. So we might think that maybe this is why. There needs to be provision, and she's reaching out to him for provision. He certainly was concerned about her provision at his death, right? He spoke to John, the author of this gospel, woman or son, behold your mother, mother, behold your son, committing her care into the hands of John. But this was more than just information. It's more than a request, hey, can you come help out in the kitchen, or can you go, you know, make a wine run for us? She is wanting him to do something about it here, and we see it by the way he responds to her. He says, woman, what does this have to do with me? That's how the ESV has it. Literally, it is, woman, what to you, what to me? It's the same question the demons ask Jesus when they say, what do we have in common with you? What do you have to do with us, O Jesus, Son of God, Jesus of Nazareth? What do we have in common? We're interested in two entirely different things. We're going in two separate directions. Our thoughts are not in common here at this moment over this object. And we should note, it's not that Jesus doesn't care about this couple and their potential embarrassment. I mean, he does help out after all. But he follows that up by saying, again, in verse 4, my hour has not yet come. And again, this clues us into what she's asking here. When Jesus refers to his hour, and especially in John's gospel, it's referring to the fulfillment of his messianic mission. And it has to do particularly with his death, as he would be publicly revealed to Israel and largely, by and large, publicly rejected by Israel. As we get to the end of what we've called the Book of Signs, you get to the end of chapter 12, beginning of chapter 13. This is when Jesus is preparing for his death, and he says, John says, he knew that his hour had come. So his hour had not come here, he tells Mary, but later, when he's about to die, he knows that his hour has come. So he understands that what she's asking here is provision according to his messianic office. She knows the promises that were made to her concerning her son, who he would be. And so she goes to him. After all, the prophet spoke of, they're out of wine. The prophet spoke of the messianic age as being a time where the wine would flow. My son is the one who provides the wine for the people of God. It makes sense that she would go to him. But he says, my hour has not yet come. So he addresses her in this way, not as mother, but as woman. Mothers, how do you would you like for your children to address you as woman? Or even your husband for that matter. It's not quite as rude as we would have it in our own culture, but at the same time it's not mom, is it? It's not a term of affection. He is keeping her at a bit of a distance here. When he refers to her as woman, he's saying, it is a gentle rebuke. This is not the sort of thing, woman, that you can manipulate or that you would have authority over me as my mother. His messianic work, although, again, as the prophet spoke of it as an age flowing with wine, it could not be controlled by Mary. It could not be controlled by anyone else. His revealing himself to Israel, his life, his ministry, his mission, his time, his death, all of this was submitted wholly to his Father. So what does she do? Well, she concedes to him. She goes, and it's almost as though you could see her with her hands in the air. Do whatever he tells you to do. She instructs the servants to do whatever he says. It's out of her hands. She can do no more. And I think Mary is a good example for us here. I mean, how many times in our requests of the Lord, right, in our prayers, have we rushed ahead? How many times have we asked, maybe even for good things, but we've done so with mixed motives, impure motives. We've done so in a way that was according to our own wisdom, according to our own sense of timing. And ultimately, what must we do but what Mary did here? We must leave it with him. It's whatever he says. I love those assuring words from John Owen in our concerning our prayers. He says, in answering our prayers, the Lord will either give us what we ask or he'll give us what we should have asked. As we ask according to Christ and his intercession for us, and as the Holy Spirit intercedes for us, and as God has promised to work all things for the good of his people. So that is the moment of Jesus' first sign. And that sets the scene for what's happens next, and that is the miracle of Jesus' first sign. This is what actually happened, what he did. Again, it wasn't that Jesus was unwilling to help. He just was not going to act on the terms that Mary brought to him. He opts instead of at this time to call them together to reveal himself by providing wine in some way. He opts to do it in a very quiet way. And doesn't this go along with what he says to people so often as he heals them? Don't tell anyone about this, right? It's not time yet for him to be revealed. So what does he do? He instructs the servants in verse 6. We read about these stone water jars, and he instructs them there. They were for the Jewish rites of purification. He instructs them to fill these with water. They filled them to the brim, and then to take some out for the master of the feast, which they did as well. And this master of the feast did not know where the wine came from, but the servants did. So it was a quiet miracle. But not only does John tell us it was a quiet miracle, he speaks of it being a quantitative miracle. Notice the water jars here. Stone water jars used for Jewish rites of purification. Now, we're not sure which rite or what rites are being spoken of here. There were various rites of washing and cleansing that God prescribed for his law, but there were also all sorts of traditional man-made rites that they had added to God's law. But they were obsessed with ritual cleansing, washing their hands, washing their utensils, even their dining couches. And these stone jars are not jars of clay, not earthen vessels. They would not have, they were at least understood to not have had those earthly, dirty contaminants there. And they each held, according to our standards of conversion, the measures that John provides, we gather something like 20 to 30 gallons each, filled to the brim with water. So this is not a small thing. Something like 100 to 150 gallons of not only wine, but good wine, right? And so it's not only a quiet miracle or a quantitative miracle, but a qualitative miracle as well. We see this from what the master of ceremonies said regarding the wine as he tasted it. Now, of course, liberals have their way of explaining away this sign, just as they do all the miracles of Jesus. They're allergic to anything supernatural. And so they say that the old wine was in here, but you know, it was almost out, and there was a little bit of wine at the bottom. The dregs were left, so they filled it with water, and it sort of had the taste of wine, which just does complete injustice to what it makes a fool of the master of ceremonies here, doesn't it? As though people wouldn't know the difference. Not according to the MC. He tastes the wine. And it's so good, he has to talk to the bridegroom about it. When the master, verse 9, when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom, and notice what he said. Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now. He's amazed at this. This is an unconventional thing. But he praises the prudence here of the bridegroom. And he says to him, usually, you know, people put out their best for their guests to begin with. You want to make a good impression. You want that first taste to be the best that you have to offer. And then when men have drunk freely, right? We know what that is, when their senses are not as keen. They're not going to care so much about what they're drinking and what's put in front of them. That's when you take what you have left. That's when you bring out the poor wine. But no, you didn't do that. You saved the best for last. And I can just imagine the conversation here. As the master of ceremonies is praising the prudence of the bridegroom, and he says to him, and you saved the best for last, and to think, I thought you had run out of wine. Can you imagine the bridegroom nervously nodding his head and laughing along perhaps? Yeah, right. Save the best for last, of course. We'll enjoy. Whew, you know, we missed that one. What happened? Can't help but think it's a minor thing here, not mentioned in the text, but how Jesus save this couple from this embarrassment. We were going over this the text last night as we tried to do on Saturday evenings to talk about the next day. I told Kristen and the kids, this made me thankful for all the stupid embarrassments the Lord has delivered me from. This is not the point of the text, but at the same time, as an aside, just thinking of the Lord's compassion on this couple here in this moment. Something that would be forgotten in history, but would have been important to them. And then also the statement, you saved the good wine. You kept the good wine until now. The Lord always saves the best for last. Despite the popularity of certain Christian books, you may not be able to have your best life now. It may be your best life then. And truly, it will be your best life then. As the Lord always for His people, despite what they face here in this veil of tears, the Lord saves the best for last. There is a feast of well-aged wine promised on the mountain of God for His people. A feast that we partake in now in part. But when Christ returns and our bodies are raised from the dead, we will know in fullness. The Lord saves the best for last for His people. The cross before the crown, the bitter before the sweet. So we've seen the moment of Jesus' first sign. We've seen the miracle of Jesus' first sign. But now as John provides this bit of commentary for us in verse 11, we see the meaning of Jesus' first sign. If you look at verse 12, they go back to Capernaum. Now they won't stay there long, even though Jesus will make this a home base for his ministry. It appears at least they don't stay there long. It's kind of hard to tell. John is not so interested in the timing of events here, but we're going to see next week, Lord willing, they go down to Jerusalem. But here in verse 12, they go back to Canaan, or they go back to Capernaum with his brothers, his mother, his disciples. But just before they do, John has something to tell us here in verse 11. He wants to tell us about this miracle, this first of Jesus' signs, this one that he did at this wedding in Cana of Galilee by turning the water into wine. He doesn't want you to miss the significance of it. Again, it's not just about the bare, naked, empty miracle. It was significant. It was a sign. It pointed to something. It has a meaning. The sign does two things, or maybe one thing, and has another effect. It manifested Christ's glory. This, the first of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory. It manifests Christ's glory, and it produces belief in his disciples. And his disciples believed on him. Manifests his glory and causes the disciples to believe. Now, John told us in chapter 1, you remember, that he and the other disciples beheld the glory of Christ. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. As J.C. Ryle said, this is in John's Gospel the first time that he lifts the veil and reveals something of his power. The word for manifest here is to make visible. It's to make known. Jesus made visible. He made known his glory by the turning of the water into wine. And if you remember the definition for glory we gave a couple weeks ago, Phil Ryken's definition of the weight and the worth of the divine being, using those words both from the Old and New Testament, the word for glory in the Old meaning a gravitas, a weightiness, and the word for glory in the New Testament in the Greek meaning to something that's praiseworthy, the weight and the worth of the divine being. Jesus here makes visible and makes known his weight and his worth, that is to say the gravity and the value of his person as he reveals his power here as the Son of God. And friends, this morning, as you're listening to this sign being recited, as you're listening to this account being reported again in your hearing, his glory is being manifested in our midst by his word and by his spirit. And the question is, having his glory manifested to us this morning in the hearing of his word, in the repeating, reciting of this miracle, in the declaring of his glory in it, will you respond in the same way that the disciples responded? Will it have the same effect on us as it did on them? Because his glory was manifested, and what did his disciples do? His disciples believed in him. They beheld his glory and they believed. They saw in this miracle what it pointed to, what the sign pointed to, or rather who the sign pointed to. Past the amount of wine, past the taste of the wine, to the one who made the wine in an instant by a sheer act of his will. It just simply says when he tasted the water that had been made wine, it's like it went in water and he drew it out and it was wine. He bypassed the ordinary process of fermentation and did it in an instant. This gift of wine brought them to the giver, brought them to the source, brought them to the one who rules over the material world, who provides abundantly for his people. And though they had believed on him back in chapter 1, as we saw last week, confessing him as the Christ, here, because they saw the sign, it confirmed in their hearts their belief in him. That's why John records it for us, that we might behold his glory and that we might believe in him. The wedding party here is a bit like Captain Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean, who always is out of rum. But you know, this idea of being out of refreshment, being out of wine, running out of wine, it's a good way to understand the Judaism of Jesus' day. It may be a good way of understanding the church in our own day, the impotency of the church in our own day. These water pots for purification, right? Things like that, they provide a semblance of worship, a semblance of covenant participation, but there's no power. The wine is gone, it's run out. And incidentally, you think of us today, so much of the evangelical church, I think it's largely a hangover from Prohibition and all that was associated with that, but largely we celebrate the supper of our Lord with grape juice. And how fitting is it for us who often have the appearance of godliness but no potency? This was what was going on in their day. The appearance, the semblance of worship and fidelity to the covenant, and yet no power. So much of our witness as the church is of Jesus Christ is watered down, it's compromised, it's palatable to the world, it's only sweet like juice, but it has no strength or sting or power. But the gospel is potent. It is the power of God to salvation for all who believed. And Jesus came to inaugurate the feast on God's mountain. The feast that Isaiah spoke of, where well-aged wine would be served in God's kingdom. Wine is a symbol of joy. Jesus had come to do away with the stony, ritualistic, empty worship they offered. He came to fulfill the promises of the prophets, to set every man under his own vineyard. He came in to usher in the kingdom of righteousness and peace and joy. He came to give life in the hearts, the stony ground of our dead hearts, to give wine for water, to manifest his glory that we might believe. Do you believe? Do you believe?